happy that you are with us. And again, those who are visiting with us, we're especially glad that you are here. If I may tonight, I'd like to direct your attention as we begin to the fourth chapter of the book of Galatians, where the Apostle Paul talks about the deeds of the flesh. In Galatians chapter 4 and verse 16 and following, he talks about walking by the Spirit and not walking by the flesh. And then in verse 19, he says that the deeds of the flesh are evident. The deeds of the flesh are evident. And then he begins to list some of these, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousies, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envyings, drunkenness, carousings, and things like these, of which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. I'm struck by the fact that when Paul talks about the deeds of the flesh, he talks about them as things that really should be evident to us. If we understand God's word, if we truly understand that message of the Holy Spirit, then those deeds that are contrary to that message, they really should be self-evident to us. In fact, after Paul lists several of these evident deeds of the flesh, he then says those words at the end of his list, and things like these, which lets it be very clear that he's not trying to give some exhaustive list. Far from it. These deeds of the flesh are things that he expects Christians who understand the word of the Spirit to be able to discern. With that in mind, I'd like to talk with you this evening about a very egregious work of the flesh. I want to talk with you tonight about the sexual abuse of children. And yes, what's recently happened at Penn State has made this something which receives national attention, has received national attention, and I think that's good. But I think this is a problem that has always been here and is something that has always needed to be talked about, and sometimes we don't talk about it as candidly as we need to. I want to talk with you tonight about the sexual abuse of children. And for some people, I understand this is a very difficult subject because there may even be some here tonight who have been the victims of the very thing that we're talking about. So even hearing a lesson on this subject and hearing it discussed, it may be something very difficult for you. And if you need to get up and leave, that's absolutely fine. I don't want anyone to feel any hesitancy about that. But we need to talk about this. You know, Jesus said to his disciples on one occasion, you need to be wise as serpents, yet innocent as doves. And if I understand what the Lord was getting at, he was pointing out that in terms of the committing of sin, Jesus wants us to be innocent. He wants us to be free of sinful behavior. But he wasn't wanting his disciples to be naive. In fact, if we're naive about those things that are in the world, then we're not going to be on guard against those things that are in the world that can afflict us. And even as we talked about in this morning's lesson, if we're so naive about the kinds of things that go on in this sinful world, then when those things need to be exposed, when those things need to be reported, when those things need to be dealt with, we're going to be overwhelmed and not equipped to really handle some of these things. So I do want us to talk tonight about this subject, a very delicate subject. And when you think about what the Bible has to say about sexuality, that's something that God established from the very beginning as something very good. And of course, God established that, as the book of Genesis talks about, as something between husband and wife, these two adults who are in that marital relationship, and that's where God established sexuality and the expression of sexual love, and that's good in that relationship. That's something wonderful as God created it to be. But when it's perverted, when it's taken out of that, it's always something that is egregious. But when you're talking about the sexual abuse of children. How especially egregious is that? In fact, the Bible teaches in so many passages that those who are older are to be the ones who are training and counseling those who are younger. In fact, the younger ought to be able to look up to those who are older as those who can give them wise counsel and who can protect them and lead them. Certainly, certainly, God never had in mind the idea that little children would have to be in fear of those who are older and more powerful and can dominate them for their own perverse pleasure. What could be more heinous than this perversion of what God set up from the very beginning than child sexual abuse? What is sexual abuse in general? Sexual abuse can be defined like this: any sexual interaction with a person of any age that is perpetrated, one, against the victim's will, two, without consent, or three, in an aggressive, exploitative, manipulative, or threatening manner. Now, that's a human definition. I think it's a very good one. In fact, let me make this point I meant to make a second ago. Do you know why I'm having to give you a human definition of this term, sexual abuse? The Bible nowhere, to my knowledge, speaks about at least child sexual abuse. I don't know of any occasion in Scripture that I can think of where there's an incident of what we would call child sexual molestation. But I think that just shows us how egregious this is. That just shows us how heinous this is and how unthinkable it is. And so when we look at what we're talking about here with just sexual abuse in general, the emphasis in all of this is that which is perpetrated against that person's will without their consent, or in some way exploiting them or manipulating them or threatening them. And that's sexual abuse. And that's something which God teaches is absolutely against His will. It's one of those things that ought to be self-evident to us because it's clearly not what God set up in a positive way from the very beginning. I want us to be wise as serpents about some things. And I think everybody needs to really be aware of the prevalence of this problem of child sexual abuse. Do you realize that one out of every six or seven children will be sexually abused by the time they turn 18? If you're talking girls, one out of every three girls is going to be sexually abused. That's how common that is. One out of every six or seven boys before they pass 18 years of age are going to be sexually abused. This is how common this problem is. And again, even the statistics that you see on this and those that I'm showing you here, there's always a big question mark about whether or not our statistics are accurate because of the concern about underreporting. Because one of the problems with this sin is that so often it does not go reported, and so we're not totally sure about these figures, but it seems to be that one in every three girls and one in every six or seven boys are going to be sexually molested at some point. That's a horrible statistic. And in fact, what we also need to understand is that 50% of those girls and boys who are sexually molested, 50% are going to be sexually molested again. It doesn't just happen one time to them. And do you know who are the most likely children to be sexually abused? The young people I'm looking at right now. Because it's the good kids. It's the kids who are brought up in religious homes. It's the kids who are taken to church by their parents, who are taught to respect those who are older, to respect adults, to be polite. That's the kind of training that, of course, every parent needs to be giving their child. And yet, the heinous nature of this kind of sin is that those people who perpetrate it, they prey especially upon those children who are the good kids from good homes, who are taught to be polite and respectful. They're the ones who are more easily manipulated by someone older and someone who can threaten them, someone who can exploit them. So this is why this is such a problem. And that's why it's something that we need to address. Let me give you another fact. 95% of sexually abused children know who the perpetrator is. They've known him. That person has had a part in their life before the sexual abuse ever took place. Over 95%. Because that perpetrator of sexual abuse, it's a relative. It's maybe a father in some cases, or a stepfather, or an uncle, or a brother. It's some relative, someone that you're taught, in fact, you just by nature expect, since they're a member of your family, that that's a person that you can trust, that that's a person who would protect you, not abuse you. And yet this is why this is such an emotionally debilitating kind of sin that is perpetrated on a child. If it's not a relative, it's going to be a close family friend. Someone who is in the home all the time. Someone whom the parents know. And so here is very often the very individual who then abuses that child. And you know this person and trust that person very well. Sometimes it's a neighbor, again, someone that you trust, or at least it's someone who is an acquaintance to that child. Over 95% of the sexual abusers are in this kind of a relationship with that child that they abuse. And 85% of sexual abuse incidents, do you know where they take place? In the home. In the child's own home. And again, because the perpetrators are relatives or friends or neighbors, and they've been in the home, and think about what that does to a child. Not only are they sexually abused, but think about the impact that has upon them. Because the person who is perpetrating this upon them is someone that they're supposed to trust, and yet look at what that person is doing to them. It doesn't connect. And it takes place 85% of the time in the home, and the home is supposed to be your safe haven, isn't it? And yet instead your home becomes the place where this horrible act occurs to you. And again, as we've said, in 50% of the cases, it doesn't just happen one time. It happens again, and sometimes again, and again, and again. This is what we're talking about. This is what we're talking about when we speak about sexual offenders and the sinful things that they do. You know, the vast majority of sexual offenders are males. It's like, I think about 97% are males. The vast majority are repeat offenders. And this is something else I think it's important for us to be wise about. Like Jesus said, be wise as serpents. We need to understand this. That when that person is finally caught, or maybe even arrested and convicted of that sexual abuse crime, usually, that's not the first time it happened. No, there were who knows how many previous occasions that finally led up to that, when it finally was reported or he finally was caught and stopped. But these are the kinds of things that happen over and over again. That's another reason why, as we talked about in this morning's lesson, it's so absolutely crucial for good people to not just stand by idly and silently when they begin to suspect that something untoward is going on. They need to expose that which is sinful. Because if they don't, this is going to happen again and again and again. And in our naivete, we dare not think that, oh, well, so-and-so did this one time and it won't happen again. That's just not how it works. And we're naive to a fault if that's what we think. At least 30% of reported sexual abuse cases are perpetrated by juveniles. In fact, those adults who sexually abuse children, they didn't start doing that just in their adult years. They usually started in their teenage years. And so that's the reason why this stat indicates, in fact, some statistics suggest it's really over 50%. But at least 30%, maybe even 50% of reported sexual abuse cases were perpetrated by juveniles. In fact, one of the most common scenarios is where you've got maybe a juvenile boy of about 14 or 15 years of age sexually abusing some girl that he knows who's maybe 7 or 8. And please let no one think that what we're talking about here, or that maybe what's being misunderstood here, is maybe just that ordinary, natural kind of childhood curiosity about body parts and sexuality. And so, well, that's really all that we're talking about here. No, that's not what we're talking about. Because that which I just said, that's the kind of thing that happens normally and naturally with kids who are the same age and have questions and those kinds of things. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking here about a great gap between the ages. As I said, maybe a 14 or 15-year-old teenage boy and a 7 or 8-year-old girl. And that is absolutely not normal. That absolutely is sexual abuse. And that's where all of this so often starts. And so we need to understand something, I think, even about the childhood of sexual offenders. I do think it's helpful for us to have maybe some understanding of that. Those who are experts in this field look at some of the psychological components that lead people to have this kind of problem. Very often the childhood of sexual offenders is a childhood where male lacked any kind of confidant figure, lack any kind of good relationship with someone as he was growing up that he could confide in, he could rely upon. Very often there's an unhealthy kind of sexual environment in that home. Sometimes it's an overly sexualized environment. Very often those who are child abusers, there's a definite connection that has been linked with pornography at that very, very young age. Or sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's a sexually repressive home environment. But for whatever the reason, there is some kind of a dysfunction in that regard. In their book, Juvenile Sexual Offending, Ryan and Lane say this: many child molesters, like other persons who maltreat children, have a history of significant family disruption, neglect, or abuse in their earlier years. Very often, those who grow up to be sexual abusers of children were themselves sexually abused in their childhood years. The most pervasive element in those who maltreat children is the feeling of not having been adequately cared for or loved. And sometimes in ways that I really can't understand, I don't know if anyone can fully understand this, but in some ways, those needs that were not met when they were children, the wires get crossed and they get attached to a sexual kind of pleasure, and then you've got now a sexual dysfunction and an attraction for little children, and then you have these sexual offenders. Now, I want us to understand this. We need to understand that sexual offenders are not impulsive. We're not talking here about people who have some problem where on the spur of the moment they have an impulse that they just can't resist. That's not the case. That's not what any of the studies indicate. And I'm not suggesting I'm some expert in this, but if you read any kind of literature on this, this is very apparent. Sexual offenders are not impulsive people. No, they plan what they're doing very carefully. Even the incident that has gained such notoriety here at Penn State. Very clear, very obvious, very planned. Not an impulsive kind of thing at all. Sexual offenders know what they are doing is wrong. They know that it's wrong. And yet they still do that. And it's not the kind of thing where they can't help themselves because the impulse is just so strong. No, they don't do it all the time when people are there. They plan and manipulate so that it's done in secret where nobody is there. It's them and the child. They arrange the circumstance where they can be secretive about it. And then when it's not a situation where they can get away with it, they are then able to control the impulse. So again, we need to understand that they know what they are doing is wrong and they do it anyway. And we need to get this point. Sexual offenders are not helped by people excusing them because, well, they were victimized when they were children. As we said, yes, very often that is the case, that those who grow up to be sexual abusers, they were abused themselves. But you're not helping that person with the sexual abuse problem by ever making that person think that because he had been sexually abused, that that excuses what he does. We live in a society in general where we want to excuse all manner of behavior, all manner of immoral decisions on the grounds of, well, the person has this disease or he has this psychological problem. And what we, for heaven's sake, need to get to the point where we realize all of those things explain temptation and why it's so strong. Bible teaches, no matter what that temptation is, you don't have to give in to it. So all these things may explain why a person has that kind of deviant sexual behavior, but it doesn't excuse his decision to act on it. And you're never helping. And I've seen Christian people who, from a good motive, but frankly a naive heart and naive mind, they think that they're somehow reaching out and helping this sexual offender by excusing the behavior because they were victimized themselves. Yes, they do need to receive help and consolation about that, but never to the point where they're excused for what they have done. And that's something that in our day and age, we especially need to understand. Let's talk about the victims of sexual abuse now. What are the effects of sexual abuse? Well, first of all, there are physical effects very often. Physical harm that is done. And you can imagine what that could be. But even beyond that, there are emotional scars, other kinds of difficulties. So often there's a sense of helplessness that this little child has now, because this little child who is a child, it was never designed by God to be introduced to that kind of adult sexual behavior. Their minds can't even fathom that and wrap themselves around, and they can't wrap their minds around that. And there's a sense of helplessness because the person who has done this to them that they don't like, and they don't know what to do because that person is someone that they trust, and that's the family friend, and mom and dad have him in the house, and he's best friends with mom and dad, or he's uncle so-and-so, or he's the older brother, or whoever, and so there's a disconnect there, a great sense of helplessness. A child cannot work all that out in their minds. Just imagine how that would be for that child. The emotional trauma that they go through as a result of that. And how in the world are they supposed to work that out all by themselves? And yet that's what their little minds and hearts try to do. There's so often a great sense of guilt that the child feels, this abused child. Of course, we can look at that and we can see from our adult perspective that child shouldn't feel guilt, doesn't need to feel guilt. They're the victim. This was a crime and immorality perpetrated on them. They're not guilty of anything. And yet the child can't compute all of that. The child just knows, well, this is wrong. And here I am and I'm involved in this. And so they begin to feel great, tremendous guilt about this. How are they supposed to handle that? Any doubt that those who are victims of sexual abuse have low self-esteem? Of course they do. And so many fight with this then the rest of their lives, especially when maybe they don't get the help that they could get for whatever reason. They don't feel that they can. They can't get up enough strength to even get help. And so they're plagued with low self-esteem all of their lives and anxiety and worry. And again, their world has been shattered. Their safe haven has been shattered because they were sexually abused by this relative or this friend in my own home. And of course, they have senses of anxiety. Very often, the substance abuse problems, drug abuse problems that people have are traceable back to this kind of problem. Again, not to excuse any of that, but you can see why that would be a real problem, a real trap that someone who was sexually abused might fall into. Eating disorders are very common among those who have been sexually abused as children. So often there's then a sexual dysfunction when they become adults. And again, you can see why. Because this aberrant behavior, they were introduced into this in such a wrong and egregious way. And so yes, there would be sexual dysfunction so often when they then enter into their adult years and get married and try to engage in a normal kind of sexual relationship. And those who have been victims of sexual abuse so often struggle with just poor relationships with other people in general. And can't you see why? Because the whole idea of a relationship and trust that goes along with that, well, that was destroyed for them at an early time in their life. And so how can you ever fully trust somebody who might betray you? Can't you see why they struggle with that? So what we need to understand, and what sexual abusers so often cannot empathize with, don't empathize with, is the great harm that is done to this little child that goes far beyond that physical harm at that one moment in time. Instead, it becomes a lifelong kind of problem that then that person, that child, and then even growing up to be an adult, has to somehow deal with. This is why this is such a horrible, horrible sin. Do you realize this? Most victims of child sexual abuse can't say no. When someone begins to, someone that they trust, someone they know very well, begins to touch them in an uncomfortable way, or rub them in some uncomfortable way, or say things to them that make them uncomfortable, and begin to do things to them over the course of time that make them uncomfortable, we may sometimes think, well, why don't those children say no? I want everyone to listen to me on this. The statistics indicate at least 98% of the children who are sexually abused, they don't say no. They can't say no. They're too afraid. They're too fearful. They don't understand. Their world has been turned upside down. They don't know what to say or what to do. Sometimes they are threatened overtly by the abuser. Sometimes it's an implicit threat because we know this person. He's a family friend. He's a relative. And a child's worried that if they say no to that person, he'll be angry. And what do I do then? And they just can't say no. Several years ago, I was preaching for a congregation where there was a family in the church where their little daughter, who was about 8 years of age, she was sexually molested by a teenage boy. And this became known to the church, and so several of the church members were coming up and trying to console the family and console the daughter and console the mother and father and all of that. And one lady came up and said this to the mother of the girl who was sexually abused. Well, I just don't understand why she didn't tell him no. Stop it. Because she has such a strong personality. Of course, what would a horrible thing to say? Kind of makes it sound like it's the child's fault or something. But what that person just showed was her own ignorance, her complete ignorance. The fact of the matter is, as we said, 98% of children, they just can't. When they're in that moment, they just can't say no. And even those who have been involved in the school programs, educating children about sexual abuse and that they have the right to say no, that nobody has a right to touch your private parts and in some way that you don't like and all that, even though all that kind of instruction is given, statistically, it's still the fact that the vast majority just don't say no. They just can't at that moment. It's too fearful. It doesn't make sense to them. They don't know what to do. And it keeps happening again and again and again. And it's not those children's fault. Because children were not designed by God to have to be the ones to make adults stop. An adult is supposed to be able to know when to stop something that is wrong. Child can't bear that responsibility. Just becomes a horrible, horrible thing. And then what happens after they have not said no? Then what happens to that child? What then do they later feel? Well, then they feel great guilt because they didn't say no. And they say to themselves, well, I should have said no. And again, they don't understand that as a child, they couldn't. They didn't have the capacity. And they did nothing wrong at all. This was totally the fact that they were a victim of some adult or some teenager who was abusing them. So we need to understand that most victims of child sexual abuse, they don't say no, they just can't. And we also need to understand this. Most victims of child sexual abuse can't ask for help. It's what makes this so sad. Because most don't tell anybody after it's happened. They just can't. Because their minds are not able to comprehend this. They're worried about sometimes the perpetrator having threatened them, or sometimes it's an implicit threat. Or they're worried if they tell their mom or their dad that the person that we love did this, well, they're worried that mom or dad will get mad at them. In fact, sometimes that's what's happened when children have tried to tell. And they're told to be quiet because he would never do that. That's your stepfather, or that's your brother, or that's so-and-so. He would never do that. Quit lying. And so what does that then cause them to do? Sometimes what happens is kids, they can't just come out directly and talk about it. So they sort of allude to certain things. They say things kind of, it's almost like sticking your toe in the swimming pool water and just testing the water. They kind of allude to something about this just to kind of see how maybe their parents or whoever might react. And so often parents, again, in their ignorance about this kind of thing, parents just shut that kind of conversation out. Why are you talking about such things? And parents don't understand. And then what effect does that have on that child? Think it's going to make that child more prone to speak up? Of course not. Makes them just draw inward all the more and become more and more overwhelmed with helplessness. This is what's so tragic. Children, when they do talk, or when they allude to this, or sometimes, in rare occasions, when they come out and say something, they need to be believed. Little kids don't just make up this kind of thing. They need to be taken seriously. They don't need to be dismissed. For heaven's sake, they don't need to be dismissed. They need to be believed. And they need to be helped. Because little children can't help themselves in this regard. Let me say something to the kids. Kids, all the little kids, listen to me. Can I have your attention? All the little kids. And I'm looking at you. I'm looking at every one of you. You looking at me? You see me? Okay, I'm seeing you. Don't hide. Let me see you. Let me tell you. Nobody ever has a right to touch you and your private parts in some way you don't like. Nobody has a right to do that if you don't like it. And you can say no. And that's okay. And we're telling you right now, and want all you kids to know that, that it's absolutely good for you to then say no. Okay? Everyone hear me? Nobody has a right to touch you in your private parts in some way you don't like. Okay? Now let me also say this. If, and I hope it won't ever happen, if somebody does touch you in your private parts in some way that you don't like, and when you're at that moment, you get scared, and you don't say no, that's okay. That's okay. You've done nothing wrong. Okay? You've done nothing wrong. And what we want you to do is you go tell your mom or your dad, come tell me or one of the elders, or you tell some, or your teacher, or you tell some older adult that you feel comfortable with, okay? And don't you feel bad if at that moment you got scared and you didn't say no. That's okay. That's not your fault. That person has no right to do that to you. And if you couldn't say no, that's okay. But then come and tell somebody that you trust, okay? All you kids, hear me on that? Okay, good. Now let me talk to the parents. Parents, we need to be educated about this. And we need to be wise about this. And we need to make sure that we listen to our kids and we have an environment in our home where the relationship that we have with our children is one that is close and good, like the Bible says we should have, just in general. But especially we need to have that kind of a family relationship where our children can know that they can come and talk to mommy and daddy about anything that bothers them. And if they're bothered about something, mommy and daddy are never going to get angry at them for talking about that. We need to have an environment as parents where our kids know that we're always there and they can always come and talk to us. Let me say one more thing to the kids that I knew I was going to forget. I just looked at my wife and she reminded me just by looking at me. Kids, and this goes for everybody, go with your gut. If it doesn't feel right, well, then you go talk to somebody about that, okay? The expression is going with your gut. Just if it doesn't feel right, what happens sometimes is that people, this doesn't feel right, but then I'm not sure, and this whole thing is so strange and odd, but it doesn't feel right, but I don't know what to do. That's what I'm saying here. If it doesn't feel comfortable, then, hey, you accept that and you go talk to somebody you trust about that, okay? And let me make one final statement. Even kind of going back to this morning's lesson where we talk about sometimes what good people need to do is to stand up and speak out and shed light upon something that they observe, that they know is happening, or that they suspect is happening. I said this morning how important it is, I talked in the lesson about how important it is for good people to not just stand by and do nothing. If there's ever a situation, I don't care whether you're 7 years old or whether you're 70 years old, where you're just not sure what to do. You're not sure with the circumstance, and maybe you've seen some signs of something, and you're not sure what conclusion to come to, and you're not sure. Okay, one of the things that the Lord has done in His wisdom, He's created a local church for just that kind of thing. That's one thing elders are here for. Maybe there's something where you're not sure what to do in a certain circumstance, and so you don't know whether you ought to reveal a person's name or you ought to bring this to light, but then you don't want to then just shove it under the rug either, and so you don't know what to do. Well, then come to one of us. Or go to some older Christian that you feel comfortable with. And you don't have to give names or anything. Just give a scenario and maybe we can give some advice that can help you better decide what you ought to do. Does that make some sense? That's the kind of thing that we need to take advantage of. Because we are a family and we're living in a world where, unfortunately, there are just so many things that afflict us and confront us, and sometimes we just don't know what to do. And so I'm speaking on behalf especially of all the elders in this regard. We're here if you just want to talk about something that maybe we can help you with. If you don't want to reveal names as of yet, fine, that's fine. But maybe we can still be of help. Okay? I thank you very much for listening to me. This maybe has not been an ordinary sermon, but when you're talking about inordinate behavior, I think sometimes you have to have maybe not an ordinary kind of sermon. But everything we've been talking about is absolutely so biblical. It's, again, one of those things that it's just self-evident. It's a work of the flesh, and it's something that we as God's people, the Bible teaches, we need to do our best to deal with it and to shed the light of God's truth upon the works of the flesh and expose that sinful behavior, and for goodness sakes, try to help those who have been victimized by it. I wonder if there's someone here tonight that we can assist in some way. Can we help you obey the gospel of Jesus? Can we assist you to make your life right in some way, whatever it is your need? Let that be known, won't you? While together we